Welcome to FarmCast Radio, linking the consumer to Colorado production agriculture. And now, here's your host, Jeremy Weathers.
Up first on this weekend's edition of FarmCast Radio, we hear from Terry Fankhauser with the Colorado Cattlemen's Association. And during the month of January, they've had midwinter meetings, National Cattlemen's Beef Association meetings, and, oh, by the way, the National Western Stock Show and Colorado Farm Show.
Well, it's a brave new year every year in January, and you know, it's great to kick the year off with a lot of engagement with producers at a variety of events, but it's a lot all at once for them as well. If they go to the farm show or the National Western, we ask them to go to the legislature. There's the National Cattlemen's Beef meeting, our meeting. It's a lot for people to undertake. I think they need a vacation after the vacation.
All right. Well, I kind of want to focus in on your midwinter meetings. And as I was looking at all the different activities that happened, you know, that one of the great things that your organization does is you honor a lot of people. And I saw 10 different individuals and organizations that were honored by Colorado Cattlemen this year. It's a good list.
Yeah, it's a good list. It's fun, right? People need to be recognized for their accomplishments, and a lot of these go back a long time ago. I mean, starting with kind of our outstanding producers, both seed stock, which is T. Hart Ranch, from the San Luis Valley, great family, built a business up from the ground. And then on the commercial side, Tram Feedlot in Yuma, Colorado, the Holtor family has been so actively engaged in the industry and supportive. And then, you know, we just clip down the line, brand inspectors, law officers, public servants, landowners of the year, everybody. There's just a lot of people to thank for what they do and to recognize for their service. And they become spokespeople for the industry by nature of that, if they are not already, and many of them are because they're natural born leaders. But it's kind of neat to have them be able to talk about themselves, which most, as you know, most of those folks don't do that much. And this gives them a bit of an opportunity to do that and tell their story. So it's fun.
Well, yeah, definitely. And a wide array. I love that you include law enforcement, of course, brand inspectors, and the different organizations, the different other folks that may not necessarily, you might not think of directly when you think of Colorado Cattlemen, but certainly have an impact on your industry.
Boy, they do. I mean, and the interesting thing was the individual this year was a sheriff in Otero County, did a lot of positive things, and now he runs the Sheriff's Association in Colorado. Which, as we all know, I mean, especially us in livestock production and agriculture, your local county sheriff is somebody you're going to end up calling several times a year, or they're going to call you several times a year. And it's good to have a great relationship there.
You bet. Well, also happening, of course, this month, National Western Stock Show and Colorado Farm Show as well. Busy activities and, of course, a lot of pride in shows and sales, but a lot of business happens during those events too, doesn't it?
Sure does. I mean, for vendors, for seed stock producers, commercial producers, equipment is something that people look at fairly heavily. I know we have a lot of sponsors that work those events, and they always are able to move some equipment after the first of the year even. It was, they were good shows this year, strong showings, very good weather. So people, I think, enjoyed them. We walked away successfully getting a little bit of the stock show crud, so we, you know, even got the icing on the cake.
Well, let's look ahead at what's going on at the state capitol. I know always something to look at, and I know issues that directly affect agriculture, that indirectly affect agriculture. I know, obviously, the legislature this year focusing on roads are going to be be a big issue. And, you know, how in the world does rural Colorado get a piece of that pie?
That's a great question. And certainly transportation is going to be top of mind They'll see several bills, ultimately probably a referred measure to the ballot, to seek funding for what, you know, in many cases are really dangerous roads. They're not safe anymore. They can't handle the volume of traffic we have now, much less we will have in another 15 or 20. So, you know, rural Colorado's formulaic, I mean, that's what we always hear, right, is there's a formula for allocating traffic, transportation monies. But, you know, I think we're in the critical phase, and it's rural or not rural. We have some of the bridges we rely on in very rural places, some of the road bases, side hills, things like that. They're very critical at this point in time, and I think CDOT's going to have to basically go out and really take almost a safety-first view of where they do projects. And, yeah, I mean, we want roads graveled. We want maintainers out there. And we need those things to be able to harvest our commodities and things along those lines. But I am increasingly concerned about some of these rural bridges and infrastructure that we're driving legally, weight limit-wise, heavy equipment over, trucks, equipment. And we need to ensure that those are paid as much attention to as the metropolitan bridges and thoroughfares that need dollars too. So the sponsors of these proposals understand that. I think the transportation committees understand that. Really where it's going to, the rubber meets the road, the funding does happen, is making sure that CDOT understands that.
Well, and that's an issue that maybe the casual observer who's outside of agriculture doesn't necessarily understand. They have a view of livestock either in a confined animal feeding operation or out on a pasture, but they don't realize how much movement happens between point A and point B for livestock, and really how critical those large semis, those large trailers are hauling across the state on some dangerous locations.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's an old figure, I think, but it still strikes me every time I hear it that any given time in Colorado, there can be 60,000 head of livestock on trucks somewhere in the state. And to me, somebody that works in the industry has livestock, that's shocking. And you know, I know how many potloads of cow or sheep or pigs I see in the metro area, and there are a few. But those trucks are, if they're coming through here, they're not stopping or spending much time. They're in those rural areas, mm-hmm. driving across those little bridges within legal weight limits. But we need to make sure, you know, they're safe. And people don't realize that until something bad happens. And we don't want to see something bad happen to anybody, regardless of where they're at. But I think rural Colorado does deserve a real strong look because of the impact that those roads take. They carry much heavier loads than the metro area roads do.
All right. Well, looking at the General Assembly this session, what are some things that may come up that may not be on people's radar yet?
Well, we're going to have another state country rules and labeling bill. That's heard Monday. It's the same bill as last year. We still have many people, and we support a voluntary labeling program. You can't have a program like this at a state level. It's a national issue. In fact, it's precluded by an early 1900s Meat Act that still stands, interstate commerce law that still stands. So we've just been telling folks, you know, regardless, you know, this isn't about if you support labeling or not. This bill's a lot more primitive than that. It's about, is Colorado doing the constitutional and legal thing? And the answer there is no. States like, one other state has had one of these laws in place since the 70s, and that's South Dakota. And because it's unconstitutional, they've never labeled one product or offered one citation. The books, it just sits there on the books. And, you know, there's no sense causing more cost and nonsense in the system. So we'll, I believe, successfully put an end to that piece of legislation Monday. But there's going to be water issues. There's going to be issues related to conservation. There's going to be, you know, some rural kind of orientated ag bills a rural oriented bills, excuse me, like broadband, like you know, protecting rural places. You know, when a retailer or something like that that employs a number of people happens to leave, what's that going to mean to a community? How can they recover? Do they need some assistance? So it's good. It's positive to see some of that brought up. But we are in a gubernatorial election year, so partisan politics will probably be alive and well. So we expect far fewer bills to see the governor's desk this year than even last year.
Again, that is Terry Fankhauser with the Colorado Cattlemen's Association. Their website is coloradocattle.org. We've got lots more to come here on this weekend's edition of Farmcast Radio. We'll be back with more right after this.
We'll be back to Farmcast Radio after these messages. To find out more about Farmcast Radio and listen to audio online, visit farmcastradio.com.
Are you cool to flex fuel? You are if you're driving a flex fuel vehicle, and you may be, and not even realize it. Check your owner's manual, or see if you have a flex fuel insignia on your vehicle or gas cap. If so, you can fill up with any blend of clean-burning American ethanol, E10, E15, E30, E85, anytime, in any amount. And that helps make our air cleaner and healthier. Check your vehicle today, because flex fuel is very cool. Choose American ethanol, cleaner air for Colorado. A message from Colorado Corn.
With your smartphone, the entire world is at your fingertips. Shouldn't your bank be? First Farm Bank's mobile banking app allows you to check your balances, transfer money between accounts, and even deposit a check simply by snapping a photo. First Farm Bank is accessible 24 hours a day and available right on your smartphone or tablet. And of course, we still have smiling faces that know your name at our locations in Greeley, Sterling, and Yuma. First Farm Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
You're listening to Farmcast Radio.
Bill Hamrick is the CEO of the Colorado Livestock Association, and he spoke at the 2018 Colorado Farm Show in Greeley.
I am Bill Hamrick. I'm the executive officer of the Colorado Livestock Association. And I think Terry's done a nice job of kind of giving you a flavor of the political landscape in both Washington, D.C. and here in Colorado. I'm going to repeat a couple of the things that he's spoken to here already, but maybe drill down just a little further at both of those levels, and specifically starting off with Washington, D.C. There's three things that are going on there today that at least currently have captured our interest. The first one, and Terry touched on that a little bit ago, is the water of the U.S. Here this week, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision that rather than starting it in the Court of Appeals, that it needs to start, the review of the 2015 rule needs to start in a district court. That may seem somewhat insignificant, and maybe to some degree it's a bit of a legal delay tactic, but anyway, we think we're going to get a better review, if you will, of that 15 rule, and depending on what EPA does moving forward with the rewrite or the new language. Secondly, and for those of you who are not familiar, the CERCLA rule, that started off many years ago as a brownfield kind of a deal, the cleanup of hazardous waste, toxic waste, and it's morphed over the years into a deal where today we are faced with a court decision that started back in 2008, and as recent as April of last year, it was determined that agriculture is not exempt from reporting under that rule. A couple of constituents that you have to report is an ammonia or a hydrogen sulfide release that is a continuous release that exceeds a threshold of over 100 pounds a day. For a cattle feed yard or a dairy of any significant size, that's pretty well a given that you are going to exceed both of those thresholds. Where there is a great amount of angst today is reflected in this picture right here. Because EPA today, they have some guidance, some guidelines, if you will, about how you can go about calculating whether or not you are exceeding those thresholds. But there is nothing in place today, either from EPA or a university that we are aware of, that has developed a template that those gentlemen right there can calculate at any given time during a day how much ammonia or hydrogen sulfide is being released. And even though that does not exist, that calculation piece, the EPA says they're covered. So in this case, I guess today, until we get further guidance, it's your best professional judgment as to whether or not you are needing to report under that continuous reporting rule. Headcount thresholds, I've seen anywhere from 208. I recently saw one this morning that's up to 330. So as you can see, even in a ranking operation like that, you can pretty easily reach that headcount threshold rather quickly. Again, feedlots, dairies is probably a given when the court, and this week EPA asked for an additional 90-day extension so that they can develop some of these guidance documents specifically for ranchers, some degree for others involved, depending on what part of the country you're in. So we're probably going to get a 90-day reprieve. The environmental activists didn't push back on it. So we'll see what EPA comes up with here in the next 3 months. The other thing I'd like to talk about is electronic logging devices. Today, livestock haulers and insect, I guess that's the bees going to California, have got an exemption that will run through, I think it's the 18th of March, and then the Department of Transportation is going to have to make a decision again whether to extend that and whether it's in days or months or actually give us an extended, perhaps delay measured in terms of years. This is Bill Hamrick's opinion, my opinion only. This is a real dicey issue because when it comes up, safety comes into it. And it puts us or any other trucking company, I think, in a position that you don't care about the other people on the highway if you want to push back and say, you should be exempt, this shouldn't apply to us. And so it gets to be a rather dicey discussion when you enter into that with some of the people of the coastal elites and whether or not we should be covered. My opinion, I think long term, if you're in the livestock business, whether it's a feed yard, dairy, swine, sheep, if you are coming any distance, you probably better get ready for an increased cost in your bottom line because we're going to require two drivers. How long that gets delayed, I don't know, but my opinion is that it will be coming. Come down to Colorado, and Kerry, I want to say something just so I don't forget, because it was the last thing that Kerry asked of you. I would do the same thing. If you are not involved in a committee, an advisory group of some kind, whether it be at the state or be at the county level, get involved. There was just a recent appointment to the Air Quality Control Commission. And we did have, at one time, we had one ag person sitting on that. With the latest round of appointments and or reappointments, we have lost that ag position. And if you sit in on those meetings and you listen to the people that are engaged there, that I think, and I don't want to get over the top here, but I think the loss of Laura Teague or that position in an ag area is going to prove to our detriment sometime down the road. But for us here in Colorado, from the regulatory standpoint, we have Reg 81, which is a discharge permit. That's a very, very mature regulation. It comes up about every 3 years for review, and it takes about 90 days to put that one aside. But staying with the water quality part, Regulation 85, adopted in 2012, primarily focuses on crop agriculture because it addresses phosphorus and nitrogen levels in our rivers, streams, lakes, etc., algae blooms, that kind of thing. If you're a feedlot or a dairyman, swine operation today, you probably per se about your operation, your production area, you don't need to worry about that. But what you do with your waste that is produced on your facility, that's where the rubber hits the road. Whether you're operating under a very robust nutrient management plan or not, you're going to come under scrutiny. And today it's somewhat site-specific, and site-specific from this standpoint that the immediate focus is on the municipal dischargers. And if you go look at the numbers, because they measure it every day, that Denver metro area down there and everybody involved contributes about 80% of the phosphorus and nitrogen in the South Platte River. but yet they want to come after agriculture, and this kind of goes back to this, you've got to be on a board or a commission. We're easy prey. We usually roll over and play dead or think it'll go away, but this is not going to go away. And again, if I could get to be a bit of an extremist here, I think at some point, depending on what the administration and Congress does in D.C., I think it becomes a watershed issue. So it's not going to be just about the South Platte River when you dip your sample or into the deal of Weldona, what it tells you. It's going to come back to remote areas like this in a watershed approach. Everybody potentially, if you kind of go back and look at the 2012 reg, is going to be given a number to reach. And how do you get there? Through whatever controls, best management practices. Everybody in that watershed is going to have a responsibility to reduce those levels of those two constituents. The other thing, Rocky Mountain National Park, God bless it, we've been at that now about 12 years. There's kind of a good news, bad news thing. They still got their eye on agriculture. And in the case of the park, it is really about livestock agriculture of all kinds, crops to a degree. But my kudos go to the cropping or our agriculture fellows out there. I think they've done a lot of things to really better utilize the ammonia that they include in their cropping rotation than maybe what agriculture has to do or has done to reduce some of the ammonia emissions from livestock. So we got a reprieve here a while back, a 10-year extension. 2017 is kind of going to be the drop-dead year initially. That is obviously come and gone. Agriculture will have to come back to the table in 2022 to give a report about what we've done. The municipal dischargers, their feet are going to be held to the fire in 2027. So we've got some time there, but in that time that we've been accorded, we need to show or demonstrate that we are doing some things to reduce ammonia production from livestock. Quickly on the legislative front, Terry's touched on the country of origin labeling bill. We are opposed to that legislation as currently drafted. And as Terry said, it's illegal. It's not about a food safety thing. So we're going to see how that develops. The other piece is Senate Bill 33, which renewed the sunset on the Environmental Ag Program. And the Environmental Ag Program is a division of five people within the Department of Public Health and Environment that has demonstrated over the last 10 to 11 years that they are more than willing to work with agriculture when it comes to environmental controls and environmental regulation. We are strong supporters of that legislation. It looks like it is probably going to move forward rather aggressively. It came out of the Senate Ag Committee, I guess it was late last week. It's in Senate Finance today, probably be in the floor before the week is out, then on to the House. So the major change there's no increase in fees. The major change is instead of coming up for a renewal of the sunset in 3 years, we've been willing to write or support legislation that extends that out to 7. So we still think a sunset is important because people change, minds change, and although we've got a good relationship today, who knows what that might be 10 years from now. Thank you very much.
And again, that was Bill Hamrick with the Colorado Livestock Association speaking at the Colorado Farm Show. The website, coloradolivestock.org. Back with more right after this.
We'll be back to Farmcast Radio after these messages. To find out more about Farmcast Radio and listen to audio online, visit farmcastradio.com. You're listening to Farmcast Radio.
Solar energy has become far more feasible over the last 10 years. To find out more about how it may be benefiting homes and farms, here's Gary Crawford with the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The sun. Some ancients worshipped it. Science today credits the sun as being what powers plants, animals, the weather, every natural thing on our planet. And now for a growing number of farmers.
It powers the whole farm.
That's David Hughes. It powers his farm. David's a Virginia turkey producer who recently put in solar panels, all the trimmings, to provide electricity. Not a cheap project, about $500,000 worth in his case, which he says will pay for itself in 7 years.
Myself and my lender, we looked at it, and it made perfect sense.
So he's happy. He told me he'd like other farmers to consider solar projects and to say,
hey, that might work for me too.
But at the same time, it's something that doesn't necessarily work for every farm. Every farm's unique. So we just need to make sure we work through the process and do our homework before we make those decisions.
And there's a lot of homework to do. That's Eric Romig, Ohio State University Extension Energy Educator. And he says, before you let companies or anybody talk you into buying a solar system, first do a good energy audit of your farm, maybe your house too, and do some real energy conservation things. Romick says studies and projects have been done on dairy operations, for example, that showed that making more efficient use of power could cut use of electricity by as much as 25%.
Now, instead of a dairy farm needing a 100-kilowatt solar project, maybe they only need to buy a 75-kilowatt solar project.
Or maybe no solar project. But energy audits are just the first step. If you still want to go solar, Romick says you need to do a lot of research on your current electricity situation and ask and answer a lot of questions. For example,
what are you paying for electric? What is your rate structure? You know, what's the value of electricity that your system generates, and how do we accurately assess that? Costs for insurance, costs for operations and maintenance, the property tax, sales tax, taxable, non-taxable income. I mean, these are all things that individually seem, you know, like picking at the details here. But in aggregate, when you put all this stuff together, it can be the difference between a 4-year payback and a 9-year payback.
Or no payback.
Yeah, we see that as well.
Yes, so it is not a simple thing. That's why Eric is part of a series of 6 1-hour webinars on this, hosted by Michigan State University. With the costs of home solar electric systems down 61% since 2010, more homeowners are saying,
I'll follow the sun.
There has been a lot of interest in solar energy.
That's Eric Romick. He's an Ohio State University Extension Energy Expert. He says companies specializing in home PV, or photovoltaic electric panels and systems, are springing up all over the country as more farms, businesses, and homeowners are at least considering solar electric systems. But these systems are still not cheap, pretty big investment up front, and there's a lot to decide about whether to go solar, or if you're determined to do it, how big a system do you need? Where will the solar panels go? Will it actually save money in the long run? And how long a run are we talking about?
So we just need to make sure we do our homework before we make those decisions.
And before we even contact a solar installing business. Romick says it's especially important to get an idea, at least, of how big a system you really need.
Because every roof size is going to be a little bit different. Every home's demands are a little bit different. Is it an all-electric home? Is it a gas home? So one of the things I would recommend is taking your electric bill and looking at your 12-month average usage.
And do some preliminary figuring. Eric says the average cost of a home solar system, according to Energy Department figures, is $2.80 per watt.
So you can take that and look at your system size and kind of give you a rough estimate of what your overall capital investment would be.
And then Romick says go to this website, and here it is, pvwatts.gov, pvwatts.gov.
That website will allow you to plug in your address. It'll actually pull up your home on Google Maps. And then from there, you could actually draw on your rooftop, and it'll estimate, you know, what size of a system you could fit on that space of roof. Or you could just draw it in your backyard if you want to consider a ground mount application.
But before you get too excited about all this, check your local zoning codes and your homeowners association if you have one. There may be rules, regulations for solar systems or downright bans on them. Check that out. And then maybe start contacting solar system contractors.
See what types of systems they've installed, how many they've installed, you know, try and get some references. But most importantly, I always recommend get a couple of quotes so that you can really see, you know, what type of equipment, what type of system design, what are the warranties of the main components, comparing installer A to installer B and C.
Oh, and oh, here's another thing that you might not think about. Most systems have the panels up on the roof. Now, how old is your roof?
You know, you don't want to put a solar project on a roof that may need replaced in 10 years. Your panels are warranted for 25 years, right? So there's going to be an additional cost there to remove that to do the roof.
And then put the system back up there again. So lots to think about before you decide to say,
I'll follow the sun.
With the costs of home solar electric systems down 61% since 2010 and commercial systems down 65%, more homeowners and more farmers are saying,
I'll follow the sun.
There has been a lot of interest in solar energy.
So, coming up on this edition of Agriculture USA, we'll take a look at things to consider if you're a farmer or a homeowner interested in generating your electricity from the sun. I'm Gary Crawford. The sun. Some ancients worshipped it. Science today credits the sun as being what powers every natural thing on our planet. And now, for a growing number of farmers...
It powers the whole farm.
That's David Hughes. It powers his. David's a Virginia turkey producer who recently put in solar panels and all the trimmings to provide electricity. Not a cheap project, about $500,000 worth in his case, which he says will pay for itself in 7 years.
It made perfect sense.
But at the same time, it's something that doesn't necessarily work for every farm. Every farm's unique. So we just need to make sure we do our homework before we make those decisions.
And there's a lot of homework to do for a farmer or a homeowner, for that matter. That's Eric Romig, Ohio State University Extension Energy Educator. We're going to consider first farmers because the cost of generating power from solar is going to be a big factor in generating a farmer's income. Eric says before you let companies or anybody talk you into buying a solar system, first do a good energy audit of your farm and maybe your house too, and do some real energy conservation things that could cut down your use of power. And so in a dairy operation, for example...
Now, instead of a dairy farm needing a 100-kilowatt solar project, maybe they only need to buy a 75-kilowatt solar project.
Or maybe no solar project. But energy audits are just the first step if you still want to go solar. Romig says you need to do a lot of research on your current, get it, current electricity situation and ask and answer a lot of questions. For example...
What are you paying for electric? What is your rate structure? You know, what's the value of electricity that your system generates, and how do we accurately assess that? It can be the difference between a 4-year payback and a 9-year payback.
Or no payback.
Yeah, we see that as well.
So it's not a simple thing, and making a wrong move could really cause a problem for your farm business. But let's say you're just a homeowner. You're interested in looking into putting up solar panels to supply some or all of your home electricity needs. Romick says most of the things he mentioned for farms...
They also are going to apply to homeowners as well.
He says companies specializing in home PV or photovoltaic electric panels and systems are springing up all over the country, but these systems are still not cheap, pretty big investment up front. There's a lot to consider. How big a system do you need? Where will the solar panels go? Will it actually save you money in the long run? And of course, how many watts or volts? Ah, this part's so technical, we just have to bring in a classic comedy team, Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. They'll explain the basics of electricity.
You know what volts are?
They're what?
That's right.
Volts are watts.
Volts are what?
Yeah.
Watts are volts.
What?
That's right.
Next thing you know,
you'll
be telling me what's on second base.
Okay. All right. Hope you got a charge out of that. Back to the current subject. Eric Romick says before we even contact a solar installing business, it's especially important to get an idea of how big a system that we really need.
Because every roof size is going to be a little bit different. Every home's demands are a little bit different. Is it an all-electric home? Is it a gas home? So one of the things I would recommend is taking your electric bill and looking at what is your 12-month average usage.
And do some figuring. Eric says the average cost of a home solar system is $2.80 per watt.
You can take that and give you a rough estimate of what your overall capital investment would be.
Then Romick says go to this website, and here it is, pvwatts.gov, pvwatts.gov.
Plug in your address. It'll actually pull up your home on Google Maps. And then from there, you could actually draw on your rooftop, and it'll estimate, you know, what size of a system you could fit on that roof.
But before you get too excited about this, check your local zoning codes, your homeowners association, if you have one. There could be rules and regs for solar systems or downright bans on them. So check that out. And then maybe start contacting solar system contractors and get at least 2 quotes.
See what types of systems they've installed, how many they've installed. Try and get some references.
Oh, here's another thing you might not think about. Most home systems have the panels
up on the roof.
Yeah. That's right. But how old is your roof?
Yeah, you don't want to put a solar project on a roof that may need replaced in 10 years. Your panels are warranted for 25 years. So there's going to be an additional cost there to remove that to do the roof.
And then put the system back up there again. So lots to think about before you decide to say for sure.
I'll follow the sun.
This has been a shocking edition of Agriculture USA, and from Washington, D.C., not A.C., D.C., I'm Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
We'll be back to Farmcast Radio after these messages. To find out more about Farmcast Radio and listen to audio online, visit farmcastradio.com.
First Farm Bank was founded by farmers. They envisioned a bank that worked like they do, a bank that actually makes decisions locally, not in some big headquarters several states away, a bank that's available when you need it, That's why First Farm Bank drive-ups are open 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Monday through Friday and 8:30 until noon on Saturday. That's also why First Farm Bank offers web and mobile banking apps giving you 24-hour access to your accounts. And we do the little things, like getting to know your name. You don't have to be a farmer to appreciate that. So whatever your profession, we invite you to stop by one of our locations, 127 22nd Street and 2939 65th Avenue in Greeley, 931 West Main Street in Sterling, or 501 East 8th Avenue in Yuma. Find out what we mean when we say hometown values and hometown strong. First Farm Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Encompass was something that we developed based on actually going out in the field and meeting with farmers. What's your profitability and how will that profitability change if your yields are worse than you expected, yields are better, prices are higher, or prices are lower? Things you don't have a lot of control over, but you need to understand and you need it very visible as to how that's going to affect you so that you can then pick the right tools to manage those risks that you have.
For more information about Sylvia's Financial, call Tracy Tattersall, 303-886-0102, 303-886-0102.
You're listening to FarmCast Radio.
And we finish up this weekend's edition of FarmCast Radio, hearing from Mark Sponsler, the Executive Director for Colorado Corn. And like many ag organizations, they're going from meeting to meeting in December and January.
It seems like we go from one gathering to the next, and with a little bit of time to regroup and actually do productive work. I find that these interactions and relationship building, both at the national and level as well as in the state organizations, continues to reward us in our ability to be collaborative and work together with other ag folks to try to get things done.
Well, one of the events that Colorado Corn has been heavily connected with for a lot of years is the Colorado Farm Show, which just wrapped up. And tell me about the 2018 Colorado Farm Show.
The farm show in Greeley continues to be, I believe, one of the biggest, maybe most effective agricultural social events of the year. And I think there's actually a little business transact there as well. But it's really an amazing event. They had a great lineup of educational programs, and we assisted with some of those in both providing speakers and lining out details. One of the most interesting, from my perspective, was a screening of the documentary Food Evolution, which is really the first really highly scientifically sound approach, given to the topic related to GMO. So that was a highlight, but there were many other educational programs throughout the farm show that were really solid, very, very informative, very, very relevant. And as always, we connect with so many of our producers just walking up and down the halls there and the aisles, and connecting with not only agribusiness people who are vendors that we have close relationships with, but also our farmer population out there as well.
Well, you mentioned the Food Evolution film, and I know agriculture, it seems like, has been fighting some of these documentary films for so long, and now... And now we have a science-based film that agriculture can actually get out there that gives a more balanced perspective, right?
Oh, it's very balanced, and it really raises the arguments on both sides, and does a great job of identifying the sound science behind one side of the argument that really isn't present behind the other side. I would also Now, many of the prior films over the years have kind of held themselves up to be documentaries, but really were just propaganda pieces masquerading as documentaries, I would argue. And so I think we probably should be careful how we use the term documentary, but this is one, the Food Evolution film, I think definitely would qualify as a true documentary.
All right. Well, as we mentioned, a lot going on and a lot coming up as well. Colorado corn just before growing season gets underway. You get heavily involved in the big nationwide event, the Commodity Classic, coming up. Tell me about this year's event and about how Colorado corn really it takes advantage of that event.
Yeah. So, yeah, Jeremy, you mentioned about this being pre-growing season time, and we work the heck out of our board members during the winter months with all these meetings. And just this week we had a couple of panel discussions that we had gotten our board leaders involved with. And going to Commodity Classic is a big commitment because it involves conversations with other states about the other corn organization states about policy issues. We get to rub elbows and interact and build relationships too with board leaders from other commodity organizations across many states. And so this event will feature a gathering of not only corn but wheat, soybeans, and sorghum producers, really all across the nation. This year it happens in Anaheim, California. And it's one of those things where, the scheduled meetings are only a half of the benefit. The other is those the value of those relationships built across industry and across states that helps get things done when the rubber hits the road.
Well, and you talked about working your board members, and I know I have talked with several of those board members in the past, and these maybe sometimes when you go to these events in a nice place, say like Anaheim, California, you would think that this might be a relaxing vacation with a meeting or two, but you really have members and board members going in a lot of directions, and they're taking advantage of that time, aren't they?
Well, it is busy, and if anybody thinks that it's a resort-oriented vacation, they really need to join our board and become a part of the organization and get involved. It really is work. These guys are committing time away from their farm and home and families in order to do work that's important.
All right. One of the other things that Colorado corn has been an important thing, I think, for Colorado corn over the last many years is partnerships, and that's one thing that you're helping foster today. You're involved with the Colorado Young Farmers Education Association today.
That's true. We're down at their event at the Omni in Broomfield, and just myself down here today. But tomorrow we'll have our public policy chairman be a part of a farm bill panel that's going to be moderated by Lee Swenson of Senator Bennett's office. And so there'll be five organizations on that panel that will talk about farm bill. That's a key area of concern on an awful lot of producers' minds this season. And, these months also serve on a transitional board to kind of help with Young Farmers Education Association for this year anyway, and we'll see where that goes. But a good organization and trying to help out where we can, and it's another way that we sort of cross-pollinate across various agricultural interests.
Pun intended there, cross-pollinate?
Yes, pun intended.
All right. Well, to finish things up, I know as you're starting out a new year, you're going to be adding a new staff member here to Colorado Corn here shortly.
We've been handed for a couple months. I've been a noticeable gap in communications coming out of our office since the end of November, but we're gearing up. I think we've got an excellent person hired. She comes with a strong knowledge and experience in commodity organizations and works for a national organization. We'll get her in a couple of weeks and hit the ground running, I hope. Myself, we'll have her on board.
Over the last several years, obviously, I'm finishing up my tenure here with Farmcast Radio, but I just wanted to say it's been a pleasure working with Colorado Corn over the last 10 years and the vision of the Farmcast program and being able to communicate the message of agriculture.
It is so important, Jeremy, and you've done a great job, and We never know how far we reach or how much impact we have, but we just got to keep putting the word out there, and you've certainly helped do that.
Well, as we alluded to with that last question, this is my last episode as your host of FarmCast Radio. I just want to say a big thank you to Colorado Corn and their vision to begin this program 10 years ago and help me carry it out. And thank you to all of the guests and the friends and relationships that I have developed over the last 10 years in the world of agriculture. It's a story that I love to tell, and I'm also happy to announce that FarmCast Radio will continue on with Brian Ulmer as your new host beginning next week, and Brian will do a fantastic job of continuing to tell the story of agriculture from Colorado and around the United States. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for your support over these last 10 years. I'm Jeremy Weathers, saying thank you for tuning in to this weekend's edition of FarmCast Radio.
You've been listening to FarmCast Radio. Opinions expressed on the show reflect the hosts and the guests of FarmCast Radio and are not necessarily the views of this station. Find out more about the show, its sponsors, and listen online at farmcastradio.com.
Colorado Corn has made up the Colorado Corn Administrative Committee and the Colorado Corn Growers Association. The Colorado Corn Administrative Committee oversees how Colorado's corn checkoff dollars, one penny per bushel of corn produced in the state, are spent on research, market development, outreach, and other endeavors. The Colorado Corn Growers Association is comprised of dues-paying, politically active farmers focusing on policy that impacts corn production and ag, working to better the industry for Colorado's corn producers and to protect the future of agriculture. Learn more at coloradocorn.com.
If you work an 8-to-5 job, when do you have time to get to the bank? First Farm Bank's drive-up window is open from 7:30 a.m. until 5:30 p.m. Monday through Friday and 8:30 a.m. until noon on Saturdays. You won't find another bank in town that's more accessible. Stop in and see our Sterling or Yuma locations and find out how First Farm Bank is putting you first. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.